Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Welcome to The Exchange. I'm John Fort, in for Kelly Evans, and here is what's ahead. Geopolitics, earnings, strong econ data, a lot of crosscurrents for investors to navigate, and there's one fear trade alive and well. Two of our guests are embracing it, and we'll tell you what it is and the names they're buying. Plus, the setup for big tech into earnings. We'll look at whether the recent pullback represents a buying opportunity. And as Israel weighs its response to Iran's unprecedented attack, we look into what's at stake across geopolitics, energy, and defense. But we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu, who's got the numbers. Dom.
All right, so John, we've lost a considerable amount of steam from the early morning bigger gains that we saw in the market. In fact, the overall market's mixed right now for the major averages. The Dow Industrials is just about flat on the session, up about to just 4 or 5 points, 37,987 the last trade there. The S&P 500 is actually down almost 0.25% or 10 points to 5113. To give you an idea of where we were at one point during the morning, up about 45 points on the S&P 500. We're down about 12 at the low. So again, near the lows of the session, a level to keep a close eye on as we sit here at 5113 for the S&P 500 is 5115. That represents that longer medium term trend line, the 50-day average price on a moving basis. So that's kind of like why we're seeing a little bit of this action coalesce around this particular level. The NASDAQ composite 16,094 down 0.5% or 81 points to the downside. From a macro perspective, John mentioned what's happening in the Middle East, things that are happening with econ data also this morning out as well. Hotter than expected retail sales. I know you guys are going to get to it in just a bit. But the 10-year note yield is surging up by about 14 basis points to just a hair below 4.64%. Meanwhile, benchmark crude prices for U.S. benchmark prices, $84.69, in essence, maybe shrugging off some of that Middle East conflict that's going on. Even gold futures are flat on the session for that safe haven trade. Bitcoin is up fractionally about 0.1%, 64,262. And the defense trade was up more at one point in the day, but it's up about 0.3% on an ETF basis for the industry. And the stock of the day, the earnings headliner, is on the financial side of things. The latest big bank to report is Goldman Sachs. It's up about 3% right now, $401 and change per share. And it's been a nice move overall for Goldman Sachs over the last year. Better than expected profits, better than expected revenues, a rebound in investment banking fees, equity and debt underwriting, all helping out. But John, a little bit of lost steam here as well. At the highs of the session, Goldman was up roughly 6%. It's have those gains right now. We'll see how things play out. I'll send things back over to you.
All right, Dom, thank you. And as Dom mentioned, retail sales coming in stronger than expected this morning. That's moving rate cut probabilities lower yet again. Senior economics reporter Steve Leisman here with the latest. It's like a game of limbo, Steve, you know, with the lowering rate cut expectations. We're going to fall over anytime soon?
I believe you can get under that bar, John, okay, at almost any level. But a stronger than expected retail sales report this morning, as John suggested. By the way, we also had upward revisions to prior month. Raise the outlook for growth this year while reducing, getting that bar down towards the ground, the probability of rate cuts. We'll look at those in a second. Here are the headline numbers. Retail up 0.7. The estimate was just 0.3. They took the 0.9 from February. The 0.6 from February, ratcheted that up to 0.9. Take out autos, 1.1 versus a measly, which was still pretty strong there. Estimate of 0.5. They ratcheted up February, doubled it to 0.6 from 0.3. Where was it strong? Online 2.7. Remember Amazon had that promotional week? There were also issues of where Easter was in the month compared to April the prior year. But also they were spending at bricks and mortar stores up 1.1. Building materials up as well. Autos down. We knew that. Part of that is price. Clothing down as well. Strength in the so-called retail control group, that feeds into the GDP numbers, has forecasters upping their outlook for first quarter growth. The Atlanta Fed raising their bar to 2.8 from 2.4. Barclays writing retail sales perpetual motion machine. They raised to 2.7 from 2.3. Action Economics says consumption just isn't slowing as fast as we thought. They raised for the full year I guess they're tired of using their eraser for the consumption input into their model. June was the probabilities have fallen 24% this morning. Now 20 for June, July under 50%. 47% now was 51%. The January 2025 contract, which tells you what the market expects for the full year from the Fed, the weekend's geopolitical events, they really had little lasting impact. The big move from last week that priced out a cut after that hotter inflation number, that remains in place. That's that big cliff you see there on the left side of the graph there. Still reading reports of an expected slowdown in consumer spending. It's coming, it's coming, it's coming. It's not going to be coming. That could be the case in coming quarters. But for right now, consumers are spending in the malls and they're also spending online. There's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine, but American consumer spending is challenging some basic laws of finance, John, and of physics.
So there's talk of fear of what breaks if the Fed doesn't cut, if they wait too long to cut. But what burns if they do cut too soon? It seems like you gotta worry. Because the consumer does keep spending, the economy does look pretty hot, the reasons to cut seem harder and harder to find.
They are the only reason. Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, there are risks around this consumer spending number. Savings rates have gone down. Does appear as if there's some additional spending on debt or credit spending. The cost of carrying that credit is going up as well. I think the reason to cut is because the Fed is above its neutral rate by a considerable amount. So there's room to provide some relief to people without ostensibly, really sparking the economy. But you're right, that is an abiding concern.
Yeah, people still employed. Steve, thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Now, Dom mentioned the big banks as well at the top of the show. Take a look at the KRE Regional Bank ETF. It's down 12% since New York Community Bank Corp's earnings miss and the turmoil at the end of January. But my next two guests are turning to the regionals for opportunity. They call fears around that trade overblown. Let's bring in Dory Wiley, president and CEO of Common Street Holdings, and Christopher Marinac, director of research and regional bank expert at Janney Montgomery Scott. Guys, welcome. Dory, is this an issue where regionals in general are sort of underpriced because of unwarranted fear?
Well, it's regionals in general and specific stocks. This fear trade manifests itself for different fears. It can be company specific, industry, the economy, or geopolitical. And any of those go wrong, the bank stocks get hammered. So what you got to do as a stock investor and go, which one of those fears are playing into my stock and is it fundamentally wrong and misplaced? So, for example, something happens over in China and you have a community bank in Texas sell off, that may create a buying opportunity.
Okay, so Chris, if I recall, the KRE was down in the high mid-30s at one point post-SVB, bounced back up to 50-plus. Now it's kind of in the mid-40s. So where does it deserve to be? Because it seemed like things got a little overheated for a while, and we've still got some lingering fears around office out there.
I think the stock should be back at 50-plus on the KRE. I don't see any reason why we can't get back to 55. I know that sounds like a huge move today on Monday, but as we go through the rest of this quarter, John, I really think we're going to see that earnings and cash flow in terms of operating cash flow for the banks is still quite strong. We think that the deterioration of credit quality is going to be very modest as you go quarter to quarter each year. So the stocks can really handle some deterioration. I think the market is just afraid of what it doesn't know. And I think the banks are incredibly open, have a lot of disclosure. The investors simply have to read and listen to the disclosure and understand that the banks have this issue covered. It's just going to take a while for it to fully play out.
All right. And Dory, you specifically like Huntington and you like Enterprise Financial Services. What are the things about those in particular that you like that you would maybe screen other banks for as well?
I'm sorry. Repeat the question real quick.
Yeah, a couple names that I see that you like here. Huntington Bank, Enterprise Financial Services. What is it about those in particular that you like that you might screen other regionals for as well?
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, with Huntington, they're outperforming their peers in broker deposits. They're less reliant on them. They've gone down. They're managing their margin a little better. I expect that to really be a lot flatter coming into this earnings season. We'll see, which will be positive. Their exposure to office space is below their peers. They're growing. They're expanding into markets, South Carolina and Texas. And I think this fear of office space, which they have less than 1.5% to exposure to all their loans, plus they have higher allowance for loan loss than all their peers. That's what I'm looking for. And at the end of the day, as an investor, they're growing their tangible book value per share by double digits. Very few banks can do that. Enterprise Financial does that in spades. They've expanded their net interest margin last quarter by 56 basis points and are performing very well. And I get paid a dividend in each of them, a nice dividend, while I wait for bank stocks to get in favor. So good places to hang out.
And Chris, you like Fifth Third and Wintrust, among others. What are the features here you find most attractive?
Sure. I think Fifth Third can handle any interest rate environment. It is true that folks have been negative on them because they were set up more for interest rates falling. But Fifth Third can really navigate both good and bad markets. I think they've got a very great credit culture, a very proactive expense management, and a big reserve that I think gives them a lot of flexibility. In the case of Wintrust, the company is the leading bank in Chicago. It has an excellent premium finance business, which is changing significantly with the insurance company sale to private equity in the past 2 months. And the company also has, I think, a very good handle on both core deposit gathering as well as credit quality and being able to address credit risks well in advance.
Dory, how do you feel about Tesla? It just has not been performing this year. Stuck in neutral would be a nice way of putting it. If you look at the 12-month chart, they're making these cuts that Elon Musk announced in a staff memo, about 10%. Is that going to make a significant difference, or is it really just a demand issue here?
Well, it's both, right? He's got a demand issue, and he had an employment issue as well. Tesla, I love the heck out of Elon Musk and what he does, and he's such a visionary. But that stock has such a cult following, it doesn't trade on fundamentals, and it's been overvalued for a long time. So I tend to kind of avoid it. I think they've got some things in focus that they've got to work on. So I think I'd avoid, at least as far as Mag7, that's the number one I'd avoid for right now.
All right. Dory, Chris, thank you. Banks and a little
Thanks,
Tesla.
John.
Coming up, look at the setup for big cap tech going into earnings and one out of consensus call. You're looking at the chart. We're going to ask our guest what makes him so bullish on this name and his other top picks ahead of the print. Plus, it's a risk on world for energy. And while oil is lower now following the initial spike after Iran's attack, traders are bracing for what's next. We've got the latest. The exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
See the Dow there just about dead even, maybe losing a little ground. And we are now in earnings season with the big banks having reported. Up next, big tech. Our next guest says the large cap run-up in 2023 leaves less room for multiple expansion. But since we're coming off the Nasdaq's third straight negative week, let's see if he sees some more opportunity appearing. Joining me now is Mark Mahaney, head of internet research at Evercore ISI. Hey, Mark. So I want to start off with Expedia, because that's the chart we were showing before. And on the one hand, you see some potential here. On the other hand, predicting an inline quarter with more downside than upside risk. I mean, do you like it or not?
Okay, thanks for putting me on the spot. Yes, I like the stock. It's a number two pick in large cap. There may be a margin issue with the first quarter. Valuation here is it's sitting at trough levels, whether that's on cash flow or on earnings, around 10 times next year's earnings. So the bar is low. I think leisure travel as a whole is holding up relatively well this year. This company's got two product cycles in terms of a one key customer loyalty program and the replatforming of their Vrbo business, vacation rental by owner Vrbo business. And then you do have new management, and that hopefully is going to be much more aggressive.
Well, we're going to work on Mark's mic there and come right back. Coming up, Israel is vowing to exact a price for Iran's large-scale aerial attack this weekend. But the timing and scale of that retaliation still remains a question. Two experts will tell us what's at stake next. Plus, Bitcoin is back hovering near the 65,000 level after falling 8% on the heels of that Iran-Israel conflict. Our Kate Rooney will give us the details when the exchange returns.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Markets right now fractionally lower. The high on the Dow is up 404. The low down 26. Well, it's down 58 now, I guess. So getting worse about the lows of the session. S&P and NASDAQ also negative. The Russell faring worst of all, down almost 1%. Here are some of the movers this hour. Salesforce sliding 5% today after the Wall Street Journal reported the company is in advanced talks to acquire multi-cloud software provider Informatica. It's the biggest loser in the Dow. Trump Media reversing course after falling as much as 15% as the company files to issue millions of additional shares. DJT's market cap fell by nearly $6 billion on the dip, leaving it at around $3.7 billion. And finally, Reddit shares down nearly 4% as the newly public stock sees another round of coverage initiations. Baird and Goldman giving it a neutral rating, citing long-term risks and macro headwinds, while Bernstein says there's too many questions beyond 2024, rating Reddit underperform. Now to Tyler Matheson for a CNBC News update. Ty.
John, thank you very much. Prosecutors in Donald Trump's hush money trial have asked the judge to fine Trump $3,000 for his social media posts about key witnesses. Prosecutors say he violated the gag order that bars him from commenting on people related to the trial. On his Truth Social platform, Trump called his former lawyer Michael Cohen and adult film actress Stormy Daniels two sleazebags who lied. Israel is deliberating how to respond to Iran's aerial assault over the weekend without angering its international allies. That's according to the Washington Post, citing officials who say the target options would be locations that would, quote, send a message without causing casualties. And Colorado could become the next state to outlaw the sale and transfer of semi-automatic guns. The bill is headed to the Democratic-led state Senate after the Colorado House passed it this weekend. 10 other states, including California, New York, Illinois, have passed similar limits on semi-automatic weapons. John, back to you.
Thank you. Coming up, oil prices falling 1% as Israel vows to retaliate against Iran's attack. Our Brian Sullivan will tell us what more the energy market can expect next. And there's still time to register for the inaugural CNBC Changemakers event in New York City on April 18th. We're going to hear from some of the women transforming business, including Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. To request an invite, you can scan the QR code on the screen or go to cnbcevents.com/changemakers. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. Iran's attack on Israel over the weekend, further escalating tensions in an already precarious Middle East. And while 99% of the more than 300 missiles and drones Iran launched were intercepted, Israeli officials have said they will respond. Let's get to Ayman Jabbers in Washington for the latest. Ayman?
Hey there, John. You're right. In Washington this afternoon, Secretary of State Antony Blinken continued to urge restraint in response to the Iranian attacks on Israel over the weekend.
In the 36 hours since, we have been coordinating a diplomatic response to seek to prevent escalation. Strength and wisdom need to be the same sides, the different sides of the same coin. I've been in close communication with counterparts in the region, and we will continue to do so in the hours and days ahead.
Now, those remarks came just hours after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu convened his war cabinet in Jerusalem as Israeli officials deliberated about how exactly they plan to respond. Now, most of the defensive work on this attack was handled by the Israeli Arrow anti-ballistic missile system, but American destroyers and a U.S. Patriot missile battery also participated in the defense of Israel over the weekend. Because they were able to destroy most of the drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles that were fired by the Iranians, Israeli officials said casualties were limited to just one, a 10-year-old girl who was severely injured by shrapnel. Still, the fact that Iran and Israel are now in direct military conflict raises the prospect of a wider Middle East war at a time when the United States has been urging a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. President Biden, for his part, urged House Speaker Mike Johnson to pass a military aid bill this week to support Israel and Ukraine. But the speaker was publicly noncommittal in a media appearance on Sunday on that topic. Unclear what his plan is going to be later in the week. We are expecting a press briefing at the White House momentarily, so we will update you with any information that comes from that. John, back over to you.
Ayman, seeing a headline here that Israel's military chief of staff is saying there will be a response to Iran's launching of so many missiles and drones toward the territory. Because they were intercepted and there was reduced casualties, you know, tragically, this 10-year-old girl injured, it seems like there's a need on multiple sides to save face here, but also trying to keep escalation from happening. That's a delicate dance, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see Antony Blinken in that soundbite we just played urging, you know, restraint here and saying that strength and wisdom need to be flip sides of the same coin. Clearly, the United States does not want escalation from either side here, but the United States also committed to the defense of Israel here and participating in knocking down some of that incoming over the weekend. So the United States here in a bit of an awkward position, and Israel, you know, needs to decide how much farther up the escalation ladder it wants to climb and risk getting into a hot war with Iran that breaks out on multiple fronts. So far, it's been sort of attack, response, but a wider war could throw all that out the window, John. And so there's some real uncertainty here as to how Israel's going to respond, when they're going to respond, you know, what that might look like.
Ayman, thank you.
You bet.
Now we're going to dig further into Israel's potential response and what it could mean for the U.S. and foreign policy. Joining me now is Danielle Pletka, Distinguished Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and an NBC News contributor, along with Dan Dresner, Professor of International Politics at Tufts Fletcher School. Welcome to both of you. Danielle, there's a limited supply of these sorts of defensive measures that were used to intercept this Iranian attack. So if Iran were able to do and were to do something of this scale again, the result wouldn't be guaranteed to be the same. How much of this is the Israel's need to show Iran that it can't get away with just going ahead and doing something like this? And how much of this is potentially tipping into something far more dangerous in the next round?
Well, I think that's really, it's an excellent question, but it's one that's very hard to answer. For the Israelis, there's no question, I think, that they are going to respond. The only question is when and how. They need to, you know, we're all using these phrases, escalation ladder, restore deterrence. And at a certain point, you sound like you're in, you know, you're in grad school and you're not in the real world. The Israelis performed admirably with the Americans, the French, the Brits, and the Arabs this weekend. But seven missiles got through. They weren't targeting cities. If they had been targeting cities, we could have imagined a very different outcome. The Israelis need to remind the Iranians that there are consequences to them of these kinds of actions. How they're going to do that is an excellent question.
Dan, where's the escape hatch here? Whether it's diplomatic, I don't know, where countries get to still look strong, but also pull back from what could tip into something very, very dangerous.
Right. It's worth remembering that to place the context of Iran's attack, recall that this is in response to the Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, killing multiple Iranians. So you could argue that Iran's response in terms of, you know, all the missiles, you're talking about, I think, what one person described as a spectacular but not deadly attack. If I was Israel, what I would want to respond with is a perhaps deadly but unspectacular attack. In other words, the thing you want to be sure is that Israel's response might actually cause cost to Iran, but is not so public as to require an additional response by Iran. Otherwise, you are moving up that escalation ladder, and we are leaving a grad school seminar and entering the real world where you would have a much wider Middle East war that would be extremely devastating on all sides.
Danielle, all of this takes on a different tint given Netanyahu's political fragility and the election season that we're getting deeper into in the United States. Nobody wants to be perceived as being weak. How do you expect to see them navigate this?
Well, I don't think that nobody wants to be perceived as being seen as weak. Frankly, the White House has been perceived as weak by the Israelis on the one hand for constantly urging caution, for telling them they can't go into southern Gaza to rescue their hostages and finish off Hamas, weak in dealing with the left flank of the Democratic Party when the president could stand up. So, you know, but you're right, of course, that politics are intervening much more. Nonetheless, as Dan rightly says, we're dealing with the real world here. The Israelis can't play on two fields at the same time. They cannot play in American White House politics and defend their nation, deal with Hamas, and deal with the Iranians. So they are focusing, I think, correctly on their own national security threats and letting the White House walk this tightrope rather inexpertly.
Well, Dan, I'm not sure what an expert walk would be in this situation, given that Biden's base is pretty upset with how things are playing out there in Gaza in particular. But I can't imagine a scenario where the United States lets Israel be on its own facing an attack from an Arab neighbor.
Well, first of all, Iran's Persian, not Arab. Got to clarify that. Second, I mean, that actually already has been the message from the Biden administration. I believe over the weekend, the Biden administration made it clear that it would not support a direct Israeli attack on Iran, making it clear that it wants what's going on to be de-escalated. It's also worth noting that the one area where the U.S. does have deterrence has been in response to the October the Hamas attack, after Iran's proxies launched a number of attacks on U.S. soldiers throughout the region. The U.S. responded in force, and that caused the Iranians to have to sort of tell their proxies to stand down. I think to some extent the problem here is that I agree with Danny to some extent that the White House is sort of hemmed in terms of what it can tell Israel. I think that the message it probably wants to communicate is that Israel rushed in response to Gaza after the horrific attacks of October. But I'm not sure strategically that's worked out very well for Israel. What it would probably want Israel to do is to take its time in terms of thinking of how to respond to Iran in a way such that Iran pays a price. But again, you don't move up the escalatory ladder.
Yeah, not easy to figure out. Dan, Danielle, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, let's turn now to the impact on the energy sector. Oil prices spiking over the weekend, but retreating a bit today. Brian Sullivan joins me now with what could be next for prices. Brian.
I think it follows up exactly with the conversation that you just had with Dan and Danielle. And I think it's all in Israel's hands right now. And the White House is tied up a bit. And I'll go from the geopolitical side you just talked about to the energy side, John, which is, on one hand, you've got an Iranian regime that was pumping out less than 2 million barrels of oil a day a couple of years ago and effectively selling one ship per day on the open market. Sanctions were being enforced more dramatically than they have been the last couple of years. Iran is back to 3.4 million barrels a day. They're effectively selling 5 to 6 ships of oil per day, much of that to China. China's heavily reliant on Iran. I think the calculus, not just the military calculus, that the White House will have to make when speaking with Israel, Israel is going to do what it wants ultimately, which is what the White House doesn't want, is some direct attack on Iranian oil facilities where that volume may come off the global market. Because, yes, oil is down a little bit, John, right now, but we're still in the mid-80s. And if we see even a part of those Iranian barrels come off the market, it would be very easy to conceive of $100 barrel oil and $5 gas, not just in California, but nationwide. And the economic aspect of this, and I think there's something coming up in November as well that you may be familiar with, that will play a part in the calculus of how the U.S. might like Israel or even the U.S. itself to respond.
And yet, if you're looking for targets that don't represent a huge loss of life, but would also exact some toll on Iran, you might think Israel would be looking at exactly that.
I can give you an easier target, money. Iran foreign currency reserves have come back up significantly. The more oil they sell, the more money they make. If you can somehow sanction the money vis-a-vis the oil, Iranian foreign currency reserves will go back down, which simply gives them less money to buy drones from China. China supplying a lot of these weapons, or at least the engines for the drone. Go after the money, potentially try to sanction Iranian oil in a more stringent way. But could you do that without spiking the price of oil? There is one way to do that, which would probably go to OPEC, maybe to the Saudis, who have 2 million barrels alone of spare capacity, and try to get them to add more oil to the market. This is truly the most global of all economic discussions, because a barrel of oil here is effectively the same as a barrel of oil there. It's extremely complicated, and it will take a lot of nuance.
Yeah, I have a hard time imagining responding to drones and missiles with just sanctions.
Well, cut off the money so they can't buy anymore.
Right.
If you can't afford the drones to send over to Israel, that's probably a good start.
Yeah, it makes sense, but so little about the situation does. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there was a report last week that the White House, well, we'll put that aside. Coming up, oil prices ran up following Iran's attack on Israel. But it was a different story for Bitcoin, taking a sharp downturn on the news and still well off the 70,000 level we saw last week. Well, but geopolitical risk might not be the only thing driving prices lower. That is next. Back to the exchange. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ all right about its session lows. S&P down almost 8%. NASDAQ down almost 1.5%. Bitcoin prices, meanwhile, taking a hit as well following Iran's attack on Israel. Kate Rooney joins me now with more. Kate?
Hey there, John. Yeah, so Bitcoin's weekend sell-off was driven in part by those geopolitical risks, but there's also some tax reasons. But that 10% drop you mentioned, John, it did come as a response to news of Iran's drone and missile attacks. The cryptocurrency headed into the weekend around $68,000, right around that level, fell sharply below $60,000. Bitcoin is one of the only liquid assets that trades over the weekend. You got stock markets closed. So investors who feared any sort of escalation in the Middle East likely sold Bitcoin to ratchet down their risk exposure. There are crypto bulls out there who have long argued for Bitcoin as a store of value, comparing it to digital gold. In this case, did not hold up as any sort of safe haven this weekend. Was more proof that for now, it's going to trade like a risk asset. More institutions are now holding Bitcoin as well. Those that I talked to say they're allocating in small percentages, and they do still very much view it as a risky tech play. Another reason it sold off, though, John, tax day. Here in the U.S., Fundstrat is among the firms that had warned heading into this week that traders could be selling Bitcoin to meet some of their tax obligations. Some could be looking to take profits. And what has been one of the best performing asset classes out there, Bitcoin's roughly doubled since a year ago. It is bouncing back a bit today with broader markets, though. There were some positive headlines that were more crypto-specific that are helping sentiment. Hong Kong, for example, approved the first Bitcoin and Ethereum-based ETFs. We saw what it did to the price here in the U.S. when that similar event happened. And then there is a market event called the halving, John, that's meant to reduce the supply of new Bitcoin coming up this week. Could be attributing to some of the optimism here. Back over to you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're looking at it as a ceiling on new supply, then that's good for the price. But the escalating geopolitical tensions, which we would have thought, you know, 5 years ago would also support the price of Bitcoin, don't seem to be. I can't figure out why I keep switching back and forth what people are saying this asset is behaving like.
It's interesting, John. Somebody used the example of looking at Bitcoin through a prism. You might be a Bitcoin bull looking at it saying, yes, it's absolutely a store of value for all of these reasons, including, you know, inflation in certain parts of the world. It's got this cap on the value. Other people look at it as a risk asset. And the majority of traders at this point are viewing it that way. You know, if you think of the market as a voting machine, traders are voting at this point that it's going to be a high beta risky play. So, you know, there are both sides of it, but until the majority of investors treat it like a store of value, it's not going to trade that way. And we haven't seen that really prove out quite yet.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly has been on quite a run since the beginning of the year. Let's see, I'm looking at this. Beginning of the year, it was in the low 40,000s, and now it's at 63,64. I guess the people who were longtime Bitcoin holders are feeling vindicated, but I wonder if you've heard much about what the either newcomers or people adding to it at this level, what they're convincing themselves of.
Yes, you hear sort of different reasonings in terms of the long-term holders that maybe bought in at the beginning who have no reason to sell or sort of watch, you know, their wealth grow on paper at least. And those people have a lot of conviction that this is a store of value. Some of the folks who've gotten in more recently, institutions, for example, I mentioned the Bitcoin ETF being approved. Those investors say, you know, we're allocating 2% or less. We see it as something we don't want to necessarily miss out on. So there's a little bit of FOMO when you're watching the price go up. Those are the folks who say, we're going to put, you know, 2% of our clients' assets in there, but they're not thinking of it the same way as maybe a long-term holder. So some of the newer entrants are looking at the upside and saying, we don't want to miss out, but we're not, you know, betting the farm on Bitcoin. It really depends on who you ask. It's quite a divisive asset. And it's interesting, you are getting more of the institutional Wall Street crowd involved at this point, but, you know, they've got different perspectives.
Yeah, eventually it becomes like that Netflix show that you have to watch. So at the cocktail party, you know what everybody's talking about and you don't look like a loser.
Exactly.
I mean, it can work. Kate Rooney, thank you.
It's worked so far, yeah.
Yeah, except when it doesn't. Coming up, Netflix could hit $1,000 a share, speaking of, in 2026, according to Morgan Stanley. So what's got them so bullish ahead of earnings this Thursday? That's next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Netflix is set to report after the bell on Thursday. Shares are up more than 27% year to date. And my next guest is sticking with the bullish trend, boosting his price target by $100 to $700 a share. And he sees a lot more room to run. Joining me now is Ben Swinburne. He's head of U.S. media research at Morgan Stanley. Ben, what about Netflix has it performing so much better than its media peers who are still struggling right now?
Well, thanks for having me, John. Look, when we look at Netflix, clearly it's won the streaming battle. And what that means financially is a business with really impressive growth, returns, and cash flow generation. And when you compare it to its media competitors today, you know, that's a very different profile than what we're seeing across much of the industry. So as we look ahead, we see 25 to 30% earnings growth ahead for Netflix, 20% plus return on capital. Those are the kind of characteristics that can generate a lot of value for equity holders.
What if Netflix were to say, because sometimes companies in this position do, okay, we're going to start spending more to press our advantage in this situation, kind of like a version of what Tesla did when it lowered prices, you know, just investing in the future. Are investors prepared for that? Are you prepared for that? Or do you think that's unlikely given the position that Netflix has right now?
Well, look, I think part of why we're still bullish is actually we expect them to continue to invest in the business. They could certainly go into more of a harvest mode if they chose. But they've done a really nice job over many years, John, of balancing top line growth with reinvestment back in the business to sort of pad their lead and drive margins. And that's a balancing act. But as we look out over a 3 to 5 year view, I think if you're owning the stock here or recommending the stock here as we are, you're actually betting that they are going to have success in things like advertising, in Netflix games, in continuing to build out their international programming. All of those things require capital. But the key is they can grow revenues faster than the CapEx they spend on their business. And that really is what drives the leverage in the business, which we find so attractive.
So you expect this could easily hit, well, I shouldn't say easily, it could hit $1,000 a share in 2.5 years. Which one of those factors, whether it's advertising, expansion in gaming, maybe even doing more in sports, do you think is most important to getting there?
That's a good question. I think they're all important. It's why we wrote about them in our report. Yeah, that is our bull case. I mean, to generate 25 million plus or minus net adds a year, consistently drive mid-single digit type revenue per user growth. I think they're going to have need to have elements of success in all of those areas. We think sports is really interesting. We think it's a TAM expander for the company. We think that advertising is a way to actually drive revenue while keeping consumer prices a little bit lower, all else equal. And then games, really, I mean, they're only 2 years in. It's still pretty early. If you look at the Americans, anyway, who spend time and money on video games, they tend to spend about 4 times more than what your average television viewer does on TV. So if they can penetrate that video game sub-base within the Netflix platform, there's a lot of opportunity there.
Finally, how linked is Netflix's, at least stock fortune, to consumer spending? I know probably you would say, people would say, well, if people are giving up streaming services, they'll give up Netflix last. But if we start to see that showing up, how much of an impact is that going to have on the stock?
Yeah, generally over, you know, the many years that we've been following the media space, what we've seen is that video entertainment services are pretty sticky in a softer economy, but they're not immune by any stretch. This is where the advertising supported tier is helpful, John, for Netflix, because for those consumers that are more price sensitive, at least in 12, you know, big markets around the world, Netflix has a cheaper option for them. So that should help mitigate some of that pressure if we see it in the consumer.
Makes sense. Ben Swinburne, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, U.S. defense stocks moving higher in today's trade on these rising tensions in the Middle East. Morgan Brennan is here on set with more. Morgan.
Yeah, as you have the markets more broadly right near session lows, as we see some of these latest headlines regarding Israel and a possible response to Iran cross on the screen, defense stocks are largely higher right now, John. So RTX, Northrop Grumman, L3Harris, Lockheed Martin, which also got an upgrade to overweight at JPM this morning, they're all rallying on this geopolitical situation that we are seeing play out here in real time. Now, the key question for investors, does this market sentiment actually mean, is this a shift? So after defense stocks underperformed the S&P both year to date and over the past 12 months, this is going to be a key thing from an investor standpoint to keep an eye on where the sector is concerned. Remember, the prime contractors have already been ramping production. They've been increased spending we've seen on weapon systems like missiles, missile defense, munitions. This is thanks to Ukraine. This is thanks to Israel. This is thanks to surging demand from U.S. allies. These are capabilities that have been on strong display in the last couple of days, I should note. And yet, margins have struggled to grow even as sales have rebounded for the defense contractors, notably over the past year. Ongoing supply chain issues, lingering effects of inflation, all in focus here. Three things to watch in the near term as an investor in defense. One, can the situation in the Middle East de-escalate? How does Israel respond to what was an unprecedented attack launched for the first time from inside Iran? We know the U.S. reaffirms commitment to Israel, but also signaled it does not support a direct counterstrike. How does this now play out, especially as we do get these headlines crossed? Two, do U.S. lawmakers come together on a long-delayed defense spending supplemental, $95 billion, including Ukraine, $14 billion, give or take, for Israel? If that becomes standalone, maybe some signs it does. Top-line defense budget, it's up 3% this year. It's expected to grow just 1% in 2025, so that would be significant. And lastly, John, earnings for the defense companies. Those are going to kick off next week. Some contractors have already signaled that margin growth could begin to happen here in a more meaningful way as 2024 unfolds. But of course, right now, the focus is on geopolitics, the Middle East, and next steps.
I understand the stock reaction, but you mentioned the supply chain issues. Does that actually pan out? Are they going to be able to deliver more of these, especially defensive munitions?
Well, and I think that has been the message really for a couple of years now since Russia invaded Ukraine. Demand has been outpacing supply. We've seen the U.S. draw down on its stockpiles to help arm and supply what's needed in some of these conflicts, including the Middle East. We know supply chain's already starting to ease, but there are still some sticky points. Can those be worked through this year? A lot of billions of dollars going into those production lines to do that.
All right. We're, of course, going to continue to watch that on overtime as well.
I'll see you there.
In the same room, different desk. That's going to do it for The Exchange. Power Lunch is up next after this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.